a number of folks that want to give some testimony, some input. Most of you know the rules very well. You've done this many times. There's a few not familiar names, so it's 3 minutes, and then you'll hear a buzzer go off, and that means your time is up. Not literally, just figuratively. I'm going to call you up two at a time. Tim Hamilton and Andrew Marks. You guys know the drill.
Two more.
Tim Hamilton, Fish and Wildlife Advocacy. I wanted to sign up again because I wanted to respond to two staff presentations, and in the format we had, I couldn't until after they were over. First one is enforcement. All over NOF for the last 5 years, I've heard about unreported catch and problems with enforcement capability. And unreported catch is unreported mortality, which means the harvest models show those fish as paper fish going to the spawning grounds, which is a direct result of why you can set a season and fail to reach escapement. And I'm sure glad that this came out today. The next one happens to be another favorite subject of mine, North Falcon. I really enjoyed Bill's presentation, and I really enjoyed him talking about the vision statement because it told us what we were supposed to do. And then the rest of his presentation, he told us why we can get out of doing what we're supposed to do in my spin. The Open Meeting Act has an application not to a executive-appointed single director. It has an application when you have a multi-bodied group. You delegate the authority to the Fish Committee to establish a rule or a policy. Fish Committee meetings are open to the public because you make a decision and take an action. When you delegate down to the director, the same delegation follows when you have a group. And that's the whole nuts and bolts of the legal argument, is that, is it applicable to this group? And court cases from the past are all related to groups that we had a single director appointed by the governor. Now, the case they quoted on San Juan was another example where he said it didn't apply to that committee, but that committee had no power to pass a rule. So it's not applicable again. We hope we can avoid this, but it's a real crazy mess. As far as the Administrative Procedures Act is concerned, the Administrative Procedures Act has problems in North of Falcon because North of Falcon is modeled off of the APA but doesn't follow it. When you have an agreement and you reach an agreement behind closed doors and then you're going to install that into a rule, the people have had no input. They've gone to North of Falcon and they can't figure out what's going on. And the best way to describe that is that the end of the APA process for Puget Sound last year, the most controversial wreck fisheries you ever saw, the CES, Concise Explanatory Statement, says there was not one public testimony or one written comment received. North of Falcon is not the APA. North of Falcon is this process that we use. You have to honor the APA, and I don't believe we are. Finally, the document request after the fact is tough for all of us. You heard Ron talking about the problems. A guy asked a question, how many fish did the Indians cap? He couldn't give him an answer. And we have this discussion. We still can't get it. So 6 months down the line after the procedure, you'll get 1,000 documents. I'm still waiting from October. It doesn't handle our problem after the fact, not the public disclosure rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Norm and Andrew. You don't want to do Norm? Okay. Then Amicro Weiss, please. Amory? Okay, sorry. Andrew, I got that one right.
Good afternoon, Chairman Smith and Commissioners, Director, Assistant Director Joe. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I didn't come down here today intending to speak, but I also didn't anticipate that I would be attending Commissioner Mankin's last meeting either. And I want to thank all of you for your service. It's a thankless job. I've learned enough to know that your time and energy and passion you put into this job is certainly worth a lot more than your compensation for it. Commissioner Mankin, I want to thank you specifically. You've always taken time to help educate me, and I never knew when I was asking a stupid question versus a smart one. You treated them both with respect and earned a great measure of respect from myself and from a very grateful conservation community. And on behalf of the Coastal Conservation Association and our 4,000 members in Washington and a lot more members than that across the country, I want to make sure that you are recognized and thanked for your service. I don't know if there's going to be time with all the stuff that's going on tomorrow that will get done appropriately, but I want to make sure that it does. So on behalf of all of us, thank you for your dedication, for your service, and for consistently speaking on a voice of conservation. Thank you.
Thank you. Nicely said. Hoda? Is that right? Okay, sure. Oh, and also you wanted Solomon too at the same time? Okay. And Emory.
Members of the Commission, Director Unsworth, my name is Amaruk Weiss. I'm the West Coast Wolf Organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm here today to give some remarks on behalf of our more than 26,000 Washington residents. I have a bunch of notes. I don't know if I can do it in 3 minutes, but I'll do my best. So the department's report that we just saw presented today, and which I had a chance to read myself, it vindicates what we and countless scientists have been saying, that lethal control, killing wolves to address conflicts with livestock, is A, expensive, B, not effective in deterring depredations, and C, the attempts to kill wolves don't always result in a clean shot and a humane death. The report also establishes that despite knowledge that wolves and cattle were mixing together as early June, there were absolutely no additional steps taken by the agency or the rancher to implement additional proactive measures to avoid predictable conflicts until a calf was discovered dead a month later. And despite what we just heard today, that the den site was confirmed at the end of the summer, advisory reports that Donnie put out to large listservs indicated that the den site was confirmed as of June 30th. That's 2.5 weeks after those two wolves were collared and 9 whole days before the first depredation, but no additional steps were taken. It's not enough for the department to say, we had a protocol in place and we followed it and the ranchers followed it. First of all, it's highly questionable whether or not the protocol was followed with respect to proactive sanitation. From the report's description itself and from the event chronology document, it's really clear that the sanitation that was confirmed as having been done was reactive after the carcasses were found. And secondly, the terrain where this occurred, it's repeatedly described in this report by the department as being very dense, very rugged. This tells any thinking person that just having one proactive measure of putting out larger weight calves, that's wholly, wholly insufficient. So if the department thinks it was obligated to only go by the protocol, it's wrong. It was incumbent on the department to itself act proactively to head off very predictable conflicts. We're troubled by what this report reveals. We're deeply saddened that 7 wolves in the pack were killed following an apparent lack of action to reduce the risk of highly predictable conflicts. But we're also troubled by what's not in this report. There's nothing in the report about interactions between WDFW and the Forest Service prior to or while this whole train wreck was happening. And there's nothing in this report in the way of soul searching. Nothing by the department saying, what do we do right? What can we make better? What do we do wrong? Why was it wrong? What are we going to do so that doesn't happen again? I'll just close with this comment. The killing of the Profanity Peak pack wolves in this report actually demonstrates that the department and the ranchers should be focusing on non-lethal measures to deter conflicts proactively from the moment that wolves and cattle are known to be in close proximity, and we hope to work with the department to develop a better protocol that truly focuses on proactive non-lethal measures before the state ever moves to kill wolves in response to depredations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, well, why don't you guys go?
Let's get ready. Neither of us actually do this. But initially, I had prepared my own presentation, but as often happens in the final hours, voices who often go unheard reach out and ask me to be their voice. Last night, I was asked to read the following letter from a friend and colleague who is a rancher. I owned and managed a conventional 300-cow dairy on the same farm that I've lived on my whole life until 2003. In 2003, I started raising 100% grass-fed and finished Angus beef. I currently have 352 cattle that I run on 500 acres and several parcels within 8 miles of my home farm. I've been following the wolf controversy for a couple of years. 10 years ago, I thought wolves should never be introduced, and if they showed up, the wolf should be shot dead. I've read books and articles written by Richard Manning, Alan Savoy, Alan Nation, and others about the problems of current range and cattle management. What an eye-opener to a lifetime dairyman turned cow-calf rancher. I was a conventional dairyman who tried to stay current with all the glossy print advertisements in free magazines. I get very frustrated when good farm organizations like the Farm Bureau, Cattlemen's Association, Dairy Federation, and Grange feel obliged to support a bad actor because of the possibility of court decisions or new legislation that would adversely affect the majority of farmers who are doing right. Wolves and predators are very important to the health of the environment, grasslands, and large animals. Bison survived in the plains because the wolves kept the bison in large herds and kept them moving. Predators kept the herd healthy by killing the sick or weak. Cattle on the range seem to be very scattered, a couple here, some there, over thousands of acres. Cattle become easy prey. Range grasslands' best species are being overgrazed and die while undesirable species overgrow and become excellent fuel for wildfire. I have a cow-calf farm in Chimicum. Cougar and coyotes are problems on a couple of my neighbor's farms. I can honestly say I do not have any problems. By calving in February, the babies are a couple of months old by the time Mama Coyote needs to feed her babies. I do not calve near the woods. I can see the entire calving pasture from my house. Woven wire with an electric wire is a typical fence for mama and babies. I do not try to fence predators out. I leave limited access and exit openings. This way the cattle learn that predators are around and predators feel like they're getting trapped. I have heard a rancher say that one of his cows hadn't been seen for a couple of years. She was living in the wild and had a couple unbranded calves. He thought she had been killed by a predator. The solution? One, eliminate 5% of all opinions of the out end of each side of the bell curve. Two, form a committee whose attitude is make it be fair. Three, take a holistic approach. Consider the wolf lover, the rancher, grasslands, fire issues, and economy of communities. Four, ranchers must be better managers of cattle and the environment. Five, wolf lovers need to realize ranchers need income. Six, enforcement with teeth. Seven, entire packs should not be killed. I feel a lot of ranchers' wolf problems could be solved with better management, well-fenced calving areas, frequent rotational grazing, and not having strays miles apart will greatly reduce wolf killings of cattle and sheep. Ranchers should never turn out 500 head in the spring and do nothing till roundup and expect to find all his cattle. Thank you. Roger Short.
Thank you, Helen. And Solomon?
Okay. I'm here on behalf of a song produced by Stephen Newton at Island Music Guild. This song was written by Nancy Woodsman and done by my younger brother's band, Galaxy Tea Party. This song expresses our thoughts and views on the current wolf situation, so listen to the lyrics.
Solomon, you are indeed lived up to your name as being a very wise young man. So,
yay.
Thank you, and please thank Nancy Woodsman for putting good words to a great song. Thank you.
And those kids?
Yes. We need more of them to come like you to be part of this whole exercise. So go forth, Solomon, and do great things. And now... Paula, what are you going to be performing?
top act of Paula.
And Sean, you're the last act of the day, so we have high hopes for you two. And maybe, is this going to be a duet?
I'm doing it,
Yeah, you guys can't follow that. So.
No, we can't.
Thank you. Chair Smith and commissioners for listening to all of our testimonies. So my name is Paula Swedeen. I work for Conservation Northwest. I'm the carnivore policy lead, and I'm on the Wolf Advisory Group. And so my comments are unscripted, but I did feel like it was important as a WAG member to come say a few things. And so one of the things that I want to make sure you're aware of is that was a really wrenching episode to go through. And we did work hard to come up with a protocol that did require proactive deterrence, that did require both the ranchers and the department, you know, doing whatever they could to prevent depredations. And I'm not going to sit here and say that it's perfect or that everything was done perfectly. But I did want to point out that I think department staff maybe were too humble in their presentation today or didn't take enough time to tell you how much they did or how much the range riders that the producer staff hired, or the contract range riders, did once they discovered the first depredation to try to prevent the rest of them. And, you know, we were on the phone with them a lot. And, you know, department staff, even though they had been out you know, late at night and up early in the morning, did take the time to talk to everybody and describe their actions out on the ground, and they were heroic. I mean, nobody wanted to see more livestock die, and nobody wanted to see wolves die. But it happened anyway, and it was a messy, messy, difficult situation. And I guess the second thing I wanted to share is that even before we started talking about the lethal removal protocol, the WAG spent months and months talking about preventative measures, like what they are, what quality implementation is, how do we get as many ranchers as possible adopting these practices, how do we get resources into their hands. And so that part isn't taken lightly. But that being said, in retrospect, and this is something that I know my organization will be recommending as part of the WAG, is that, you know, in an open range situation like that, and, you know, I do have to agree with Amaruk on this, is when you know, when we know there's the potential for conflict, I mean, you can't always predict it. And, you know, Commissioner Keeney talked about some of the data that we've seen out there is that sometimes cows and wolves can be in close proximity and there isn't anything that happens, but we don't know that. And I think to the best of our human ability, we do need to have preventative measures out there that are, as extensive as possible. And so we will be recommending that human presence be something that's required, at the beginning of the season and not something that's really optional. So I just wanted to, I could talk for hours and I know that you don't have that time, but I'll just leave you with that we will be recommending some tightening up of the requirements around preventatives. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Yes, Jay.
Paul and I just came from 2 days together, yet I have a question for you. I think there was some talk about that the WAG didn't use science in their process of looking at developing these protocols. And could you answer that? Because that's not what I saw. That's not what I experienced in the one WAG meeting I went to. Could you just talk a little bit to that?
So the science around preventatives and lethal is still developing. And so while we may not have done sort of an explicit literature review, we did, in those months that we talked about preventatives, we did bring the best information forward and practitioners in the field. We had outside folks. We had Suzanne Stone from Defenders and Carter Niemeyer and Brian Bean from Idaho and Hillary Zoranek from Montana, people that have done these practices for years, and then all of them and all of us have drawn on the body of literature of what works from a preventative perspective. But we also know that we don't know everything around that. And then on the lethal side, does it work or not? There's, I think we all know that there's some papers out there that have either contradictory results or both of the papers say, this is what we know in the Rocky Mountains, and there's more to be learned, and there actually isn't. Actually, thankfully, we don't we haven't had enough lethal incidents in Washington to study that, and I hope to keep it that way. Actually, but science is one of those funny things. Is that researchers do their best to describe a very complex world, and we don't have all the answers, and so people are left with trying to do the best they can from a formulation of policy perspective and implementing things on the ground. So I wouldn't say we didn't follow science, but I would also say that the science isn't a perfect guide at this point. And we do the best we can in terms of our recommendations as the WAG, and I think department staff, between the WAG and department staff, there's several PhD wildlife biologists and folks on the ground that do their best to understand what the science is. But we have to be humble to know that we don't know everything. And I also think it's important to, just one little anecdote I want to share. There was a point at which we were working out a sort of a pilot deterrence plan for a sheep producer in the Cascades, in the Tanaway Pack. And by the time we had come to agreement on that plan, the producer essentially had agreed to do seven different deterrence measures, which include like three different forms of human presence. And the department had agreed to kick in to do extra stuff after the first depredation. Even if those seven things hadn't worked, they would still try to ramp up prior to going to lethal. And there was a point at which that particular producer said, you know, the goal of this is, like, I don't want to lose any of my animals, but I don't want to see any wolves die either. And that was a general sentiment of everybody on the WAG. So that's what we're trying to do. And I hope that there's more and more science that develops, but we don't have as much as we need.
Thanks, Paula. Sean, it's all up to you.
Thanks. Sean Cantrell with Defenders of Wildlife. I'm also a member of the WAG, but implicit in what Paula said, but I'll make it explicit for her and for me, is we're not here speaking for the WAG. The WAG doesn't come up, have spokespeople go out. We're here as individuals, but it does inform what we, what our thoughts, our comments are. I wanted to just comment on a couple of things from, you know, Donnie and Joey and Trent's presentation, and a couple of the comments from Paula and Amaruk as well. There's a lot of lessons to be learned, a lot of adaptive management that we need to do. We collectively, we on the WAG and the department, you as the commissioners, and the last summer was extraordinarily painful for, I think, just about anybody involved with it. But how do we go forward? What do we learn? And I think one of the things that Amaruk mentioned that I would reiterate is that there can be more detail beyond what that report said. I think that there are... the sort of the reflective piece is partly charged on us as the WAGs to go forward with that, but also would encourage the department to continue their self-assessment, and I think they are, but would love to see more of that as we're going forward. I also agree with Amaruk around the role of the Forest Service and how do we better engage them. I think that's a key piece. I'm not 100% sure that the WAG is the best vehicle for doing that full-on engagement. We are an advisory group to a state agency. We don't have any authority or even a bully pulpit in a significant way with the federal agency. So there may be some of us as individuals that could help the Forest Service engage better. But I'm still unclear of whether the WAG is the appropriate vehicle there. One of the things that Amaruk mentioned that I would disagree with, and I think Paula touched a bit on this, is that all of the horrible events that happened around the Profanity Peak Pack, I do not think were predictable. The fact that we have wolves and livestock in very close proximity in very rugged territory is, in fact, true. She is absolutely right. But that does not mean that there would, in fact, be conflict. We've got, I believe, 19 packs. I'd say at least 10 or 15 of those packs are in very similar situations where you have a lot of livestock, a lot of wolves, rugged territory, and we don't have conflict. We don't know enough to how we can predict these things. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Doesn't mean that we don't have to do a whole lot more. But I want to just caution anyone and everyone to not assume that we can predict exactly how these wolves are going to behave, how the cattle are going to behave, with the impacts of fire or drought or human activities on the landscape. It's a very dynamic system, and predicting it is a very dangerous thing to try to claim we'll know how to predict these things. Last thought just to say is that as we go forward, I think the biggest piece, and Paula mentioned it, so I won't go into detail, is just to say that the human presence as a deterrent seems to be the piece that, as we as WAG members are looking at it, beyond what we do with the Forest Service, is how do we ensure that human presence is a key piece, particularly in these more rugged, remote places. So I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Any follow-up? I do agree, and I think what Commissioner Thornburg said, I would look forward to some of your recommendations collectively from the WAG on how to interact with the Forest Service. I think that is a point that I'm right. So don't back off that totally. Just we need some thoughts on it. So, okay, thank you. All that, we're 4 minutes behind schedule, which is not that bad. So with that, I will bring an end to the 2017 January 13th meeting of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we will reconvene at 8:30 in the morning.